Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this joint meeting of the London School of Economics and the Centre for European Reform. In a moment, we're going to hear from Joschka Fischer on Britain, Germany, and Europe. But let me just say a couple of words by way of introduction. Joschka Fischer is very different from most European foreign ministers. Jack Straw and Michel Barnier and Federico Frattini have not been squatters. They haven't engaged in fights with the Frankfurt police. They haven't spent periods in jail, and they haven't been taxi drivers. But Joschka Fischer has had a different career strategy, entering the Bundestag in 1983, and then steering the Green Party towards power, defeating the Fundis, the so-called fundamentalists, and winning out for the Realos. The British Green Party, I say, en passant, sadly never had the Realos. So the result was the Greens entered power in 1998, and Joschka Fischer became foreign minister. And he's done two things that I find particularly interesting since then. One of them is he's helped change the way Germans view the use of force. He, without his intervention, the Bundestag would not have backed the NATO intervention against Serbia over the Kosovo business in 1999. And again, it was because of his intervention that German troops were deployed in Afghanistan 2 years later. That hadn't happened until then, that kind of involvement. Remember, in the first Gulf War of 1991, there were no German troops involved. So Germany has become a more normal country in the way it views the use of force and the problem of resolving security crises elsewhere in the world. And I think Joschka Fischer takes a lot of the credit for that. And the second thing he's done is really rekindle a debate on the future of Europe. His speech at Humboldt University 4 years ago was probably the most influential speech or document produced by any European politician in the last 5 years. He put forward the idea that there should be a European constitutional treaty. Lo and behold, there is now such a document, even though it's questionable as to whether it will be ratified. He also put forward the idea that there should be a center of gravity, a kind of hard core of integrationist countries to lead Europe towards a federal future, allowing others to catch up when they so wished. Now, earlier this year, he withdrew some of those ideas, and he said he no longer believed in a core Europe because he'd learnt during the Iraq crisis how divisive it was. But I would speculate that possibly, if Britain should vote against the EU's constitutional treaty, which is at the least possible, then the whole EU show will be blocked and nothing will move forward unless people revive the idea of a core Europe. So I wonder if he may tell us today that that idea may have to be revived if the treaty should be blocked by a referendum in Britain or some other country. That's enough from me. There will be time afterwards for some questions and answers, and Lord Grabner will chair a Q&A session. And so I'd just like to say very much a warm welcome to Joschka Fischer.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. It is both a pleasure and an honor to be able to speak to you here today. And, well, I will tell you something also about my view of Europe, but I strongly believe that there will be a yes vote in the United Kingdom, so I don't want to speculate what will be the consequences of a no vote. The world is changing dramatically at the start of the 21st century. We experienced that during the last years and even months. I'm sure this is also a central topic in your courses on international relations or economics. One of the basis factors is humanity is growing. In just a few decades, we will hit the 8 billion mark. And humanity is also growing ever closer together with the global networking of world trade and new communication technologies. In the 21st century, we will become increasingly dependent on one another in economic, technical, as well as political terms. Therefore, I don't believe that the future will be a revival of the past. I don't believe that in the 21st century the balance of power system, these old-fashioned balance of power system of Europe, in the globalized sphere, will define our future. At the same time, we face many new challenges, bringing dangers for North and South alike. States can no longer master these challenges on their own. This means not to create superstates, I am here to add. We have to tackle them together. Germany, Britain, and others are doing so in various bodies. We are both convinced and committed members of the European Union. We both recognize the need for a close transatlantic relations, and we both consider the United Nations to be the most important forum for global cooperation. Let me therefore start by saying a few words about the European Union. Its emergence is very much rooted in European history, the animosity between the peoples of Europe. Particularly, the arch rivalry between France and Germany was overcome in a highly pragmatic manner through economic integration. But behind this economic integration, there was a new idea, a new political idea. The old state system in Europe, the so-called system of Westphalia, based on the Westphalian Peace in 1648, the old system was based on the balance of power of sovereign states. The new system, the new political idea, created by two Frenchmen, Foreign Minister Schuman and Jean Monnet, was the idea of integration. And if you look to the 20th century, you will see a tremendous difference between the first half and the second half of the 20th century. Thanks to two historical decisions, Europe developed in a completely different direction during the second part of the 20th century. The first decision was the decision of wise statesmen in Washington, D.C. after 1945 to stay committed to the security of Western Europe, to stay committed to market economy and the development of democracy. And the second decision was the decision, the invention of the idea of integration. And integration means not, and I think it's urgent to underline that here in the United Kingdom, integration means not that we will get a super state. It means something similar like the United States, a continental state, a state federal system of 50 states with one political will. Not only in the United Kingdom, everywhere in Europe, we love our languages, we love our way we play football, we love our way how we cook our dishes, and there are important differences, of course. And we love our national states, we love our national cultures on the one hand. And this means Europe, because Europe, in French, we would say vive la différence, it's really the difference which matters. But on the other side, the integration of our economic interests, of our security interests, is, I think, an important progress for all of us. So the balance between national state and Brussels, this is the real, I think, challenge we have to deal with. And therefore, I'm strongly in favor of integration, of strong European institutions. And I don't see how we shall really make progress and defend our interests and play our role in the 21st century without an integrated Europe, without pooling our sovereignty. But this will not mean that the nation state, the national state is behind us. It means that we have to balance it, and exactly this was a challenge for the convention. This was a challenge which was really solved in the Constitution, and therefore I hope that the British people in its decision will be wise enough for a yes vote, but I understand that this is a serious discussion and I don't want to intervene in this discussion here in the United Kingdom. We have now reached an unprecedented degree of political coordination and joint action in the EU. The community has thus developed into an anchor of stability, a union of peace for Europe and beyond. And look what happened. In the Cold War, and my generation was born into the Cold War, I could never, I mean, seriously, I never dreamed about that we would experience the end of the bipolar system. But one day it collapsed. But it was not only the bipolar system of the Cold War which collapsed. It was also the end of a world order, the end of a world order which emerged from the hegemonial drive which led us into the Second World War by Nazi Germany. It came out as a bipolar system of East and West, socialism and capitalism, or communism and capitalism, Soviet Union and US, who were defining the course of history. With the end of the Cold War, it seemed to be that two big magnets were gone. Before, two big magnets ordered the whole world. And what you see now nowadays in Europe is that everybody wants to join the European Union. The big question is, why is that so? Because the European Union guarantees security, guarantees economic development, creation of wealth, safety, democracy. So there is a new magnetism, a new political magnetism, which is definitely, located in Brussels. And this means that the European Union is attractive for all the European people. And there is an important difference to my speech in Humboldt, because now enlargement is a reality. We have not any longer 15 member states, we have now 25 member states. Maybe in 2007 we'll have 27 member states or 28. Croatia is also knocking at the door. Turkey is a decision, a very important one we have to make in December. As European Union, whether we will open the accession discussion with Turkey. So this is a matter of fact that now we have the enlarged union. The second question is whether this union is in the shape to act properly. Properly means not accordingly to European ideologues, but accordingly to the interests of the member states and the union as such. And therefore, I think enlargement must be accompanied by the inner reform of the European Union. Otherwise, not only the European Union, this is a misunderstanding of Eurosceptics, but also the interests, the core interests of the member states will be hurt. Therefore, we highly appreciate that we move forward now, and looking to the world after 9/11, we must realize, but it started much more earlier. It started not on September 11, 2001. It started de facto with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with when the wall came down. A third factor has now been added to the historic and pragmatic aspects of the European Union, namely, I will call it the strategic dimension. It is immensely important. The European Union was not designed for the question of war and peace. This was not the purpose of the European Union originally. But nowadays it's quite clear that Europe is challenged also in a strategic way. In the old days during the Cold War, the strategic dimension was a question of NATO and especially of the security guarantee of the United States. The new challenges, we have to face also as Europeans, whether we like it or not, as a matter of reality. It is immensely important, the strategic dimension. At the latest, since 9/11, it has been quite clear that we were not prepared for these new regional and global challenges. We have to change the Union to be able to assume these tasks. Let me explain it to the younger people here. For you, it will be crucial whether the Mediterranean will be a sea of cooperation or of confrontation. This will be as important as the security of West Berlin during the Cold War. So, as Europeans, as Brits, as Germans, as French, as whatever, I think we must realize that our strategic neighborhood defines our security. And this strategic neighborhood mostly will realize it is the Middle East, is the Mediterranean, is Africa. And we have to give answers, we must be ready to give answers as Europeans to these new challenges. Today, a union with 25 member states but with weak institutions faces this challenge. With enlargement taking in 10 new members on May the 1st, 2004, we have finally overcome the division of Europe. And let me explain it once again. I mean, I will never forget these terrible beginning of the 90s, the Yugoslavian wars, when Yugoslavia break apart. It was quite clear that this was a bitter lesson our generation had to learn, that these continents cannot live with two security principles, with two principles how our continent will be organized. On the one hand, the EU-Europe, the Europe of integration. On the other hand, the Europe of nationalism. This was the real challenge in the Yugoslav wars, and was quite clear that if we want to live in peace, and if we want to live with our basic values and according to our basic values of the human rights, of the respect of human beings, it was quite clear that nationalism couldn't be accepted. And this was a challenge of Milosevic and his policy, not only to the West, but especially to the European Union. At that time, we needed too much, I think it needed too long, and too many innocent people had to die until we understood this lesson. But it's quite clear that this is the real reason for the enlargement of the European Union. But it creates also other questions, especially the question where Europe starts, where it ends, the question for the borders. And this is a very sensitive question, because we have serious discussions now about the accession of Turkey. And this is a part of the problems we have, at least in the discussion in Germany and France and some other member states. Even if many difficulties remain, and who would know this better than Germany, which has experienced the difficulties of growing together after 5 decades of division of our country, this enlargement is, on the other hand, a real opportunity for our continent. We have to create an efficient and capable EU if we are to use this opportunity. This is the only way to master the new challenges. And as I said before, the new constitution guarantees that this will happen. It makes the EU able to act efficiently. And let me underline the fact that this constitution is a compromise. A compromise between the more skeptical position and the more the position which tends to be more integrationist. But it's, I think, an excellent compromise, and if we would lose these constitution, I believe that it would be a major setback for Europe. But Europe means also not only Brussels, but the member states together. It will be also a setback for the interests of the member states. So we now have to ensure that the ratification process is completed as quickly as possible. And I'm absolutely convinced that we need this constitution, and therefore I'm quite optimistic that at the end of the day, Europeans will decide. One, I think, if someone looks into the historical books of the United States, you will find that process of ratification was at that time very complicated, and it's complicated today, but I think at the end it will be a success. The EU will continue to change. The 10 new members do not mean enlargement is over. Bulgaria, Romania, and Croatia are the next accession candidates. Just a few days ago, the Commission recommended that the member states also launched accession negotiations with Turkey. The decision to be taken by the European Council in December about whether to negotiate with Ankara on accession will be, this is my view, an historic one. In many countries, not least in Germany, the question triggers intense discussions and very controversial discussions. Can the EU cope with Turkey as a member state? Does Turkey belong to Europe? and other relevant questions. But we must not lose sight of reality. We face a major strategic challenge. Turkey has been trying to draw closer to modern Europe since the days of Kemal Atatürk. In recent months and years, there have been impressive developments in the country, both in terms of society and law. A democratic Turkey, in which human rights are respected and the rule of law prevails, would be proof that a predominantly Muslim society and a modern secular state committed to democratic values can go hand in hand. Turkey, and this will need 10 to 15 years, and I think the Commission made a very wise decision with safeguards, benchmarks, where we can really see that this is a process which will transform the whole society, the economy, the institutions. But Turkey then, a Turkey which will really fit to Europe, which has reached not only in the institutions, in the legal framework, but also in the society. Turkey, which has reached European standards and will fit to Europe, I think will make the decision much more easier than today, and therefore the implementation of all the elements which are negotiated is very important, and this is also part of the decision-making of the decision of the Commission. I think this Turkey, as an EU member, would thus send a very important message not only to Europe but also in the Middle East. Similarly, we must not forget that giving Turkey the prospect of membership is not a new idea. For four decades, the country has heard promises, and therefore I think anything less but a yes to the open to the beginning of the negotiations would be seen in Turkey as a no, with I think very serious consequences in the present strategic environment. Ladies and gentlemen, in recent years, the EU has become more and more of a global player. This role will even grow in future. It is reflected not least in the development of the European security and defense policy. Our attention has to focus on one region above all, the Middle East. After all, Europe's security, as I said before, in the 21st century, will be decided in the Mediterranean and the Middle East. There is one question here which is a source of concern, both for us and our British partners, a very actual one, and these is Iran's nuclear ambitions. Let me stress these challenges. A nuclearization of Iran, together with the development of delivery systems, run the risks of an arms race and a direct confrontation in the Middle East. Given the dangers posed by terrorism, the ongoing Middle East conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and regional hostilities, such an arms race in this volatile region would be nothing short of a nightmare and could pose a huge threat to Europe's security. The coming weeks leading up to the meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors in November are thus crucial. The board will have to decide whether further steps are necessary with regard to Iran's obligation towards the IAEA. All options are still open and must be used even if time is limited. All options means peaceful options, that I'm not be understood, misunderstood here. Together with Britain and France, we therefore continue our efforts to convince Iran to voluntarily abandon its efforts to complete the fuel cycle. We are not trying to take away from a state the right to use nuclear energy for peaceful means. For a green politician, this is very painful. But as a foreign minister, I mean, I have to accept the sovereign right of a state to decide how it will produce its energy. But the international community does need objective guarantees that Iran's peaceful nuclear program is not being used for purposes that are incompatible with the rights and obligations laid down in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Therefore, let me use also this opportunity here in London to appeal again to the leadership of Iran to meet the demands of the Board of Governors of the IAEA and freeze all relevant activities. We are then also prepared to talk to Iran about concrete prospects for cooperation in many fields, including the civilian use of nuclear power. Ladies and gentlemen, the key to success of all efforts to bring stability and security to the Middle East is resolving the Middle East conflict. After decades of a tragic conflict between Israel and the Palestinians and countless peace plans, it is clear that there is no way around a two-state solution. This is the only internationally recognized approach and the only promising road to lasting peace between the conflicting parties and stability for the entire region. President Bush, George Bush, has made a clear commitment to this solution, than a clearer commitment to this solution than any president before him. The roadmap, too, is all about realizing the two-state solution. Nevertheless, we can see the fronts hardening. An end of terrorism and violence, an end of the suffering of innocent people, children, civilians on both sides, is not on the horizon, unfortunately not. Up to now, none of the parties has met the key obligations laid down in the roadmap. The Palestinian side has not yet reformed its security services and taken no effective steps against terrorist groups, and these terror must be stopped. On the Israeli side, the building of settlements and outposts continues. Here, Prime Minister Sharon's disengagement plan can be a step towards resolving the conflict, but only, let me be quite clear, if it goes beyond Gaza first and Gaza only. The withdrawal from the Gaza Strip must be embedded in the roadmap. It must not develop into an attempt to move away from the roadmap and its guidelines. The European Union is ready to lend its wholehearted support to a withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and dismantling of all settlements, which is coordinated between Israel and the Palestinians and anchored in the roadmap. But the commitment of our most important ally outside of Europe, of the United States, is crucial. Without the United States in the driver's seat, there can be no solution to the Middle East conflict. And let me underline, I also think that in solving or avoiding a severe crisis with Iran, it would be also highly welcomed if we could closely coordinate the Europeans with Russia and especially with the United States. And if after the elections, whoever will win, if we can bring together a package deal, a serious one for Tehran, I think this could be really a way out to avoid such a crisis. But therefore, once again, we need the U.S. And here you see that from my view, and this is experience-based, not ideological-driven, I don't believe that there is an alternative to the transatlantic partnership. Because if you want to solve the problems, if you want to avoid the threats, and if you want to move forward in a successful way in the 21st century, I strongly believe that the transatlantic partnership is crucial and will be crucial. We agree, therefore, with our British friends that America is our most important partner and ally outside of Europe. Only together with the United States, we will be ready to tackle the major challenges and solve the problems in a successful way. There cannot be a world order without the United States, the only country that is able to project global power. But Europe, on the other hand, too, can and must play its part in tackling the challenges we face on both sides of the Atlantic. Neither the US nor Europe are alone able to combat the dangers stemming from international terrorism, de facto new totalitarian threat, because the ideas behind these terrorism, they are purely totalitarian. And because we are here in a university, in the audience of a university, it's very interesting to read what the mastermind of these ideology has really read. It's a complete picture, totalitarian, closed of a totalitarian closed world, and I think this is a very serious threat where the West, let me use this old-fashioned word because I believe in it and in its future, the West must first of all understand the threat, secondly find a way for a strategic consensus and then act together. Otherwise, I think we won't be successful, and therefore the US and Europe had to cooperate. But this must be based on a strategic consensus, and these consensus must be consequence of a true debate, of agreement, of consensus from both sides. And therefore, we need a real transatlantic strategic dialogue to tackle these central foreign policy challenges of the future and of present days. This is my major concern, that we must reach again such a strategic consensus. If not, it will be quite clear that the splits will weaken us. And from my view, this time these totalitarian threat is not based in the most powerful industrial strait as Germany happens to be in the 30s. It's not the biggest state as Russia happened to be in 1917. It's not state-based. It was harbored in Afghanistan, and therefore after 9/11 there was no alternative than to move with the military action to Afghanistan and overthrow the harboring government, the dictatorship of the Taliban. It's not state-based, but it's quite clear it's a totalitarian, it's a terrorist threat. And it's also a hegemonial challenge. Attacking the United States, as it happened in 9/11, this was not only a terrible crime, but it was also a clear message that the United States, the West, are challenged. And therefore, I think we need these strategic consensus, but once again, it must be based on consensus from both sides as a result of a true discussion between the transatlantic partners. In Afghanistan, we cooperate very successfully. Looking back, I have always mixed feelings dealing with Afghanistan. I will never forget when I came into office in end of 98, was the first time that I had to deal with the humanitarian catastrophe which took place every winter in Afghanistan. And definitely the public opinion was not interested, only the experts in the foreign ministries, because all the instruments we had, nobody was ready to use force against the Taliban, and all the instruments we had, economic sanctions or anything like that, diplomatic pressure, didn't work because they were not interested in these form of policy. So only the UN, the Red Cross, the international humanitarian organizations, and the experts in the international organizations and in the foreign ministries had to deal with these ongoing humanitarian crises, and the poorest, the small one, the newborn children suffered terribly every winter. In Afghanistan, there was a war, an occupation, Soviet invasion. There was a civil war, a bloody civil war. Of more than 20 years, the country was completely destroyed. Millions of refugees were outside the country, in Iran, in the Central Asian republics, and the biggest part of the refugees in Pakistan. If I look forward, what we have to do in Afghanistan, it's, problems higher than the Hindu Kush Mountains. But if I look back, what we have achieved since the first conference in the Petersburg near Bonn, it's tremendous what we have achieved in a very positive way. Now we had free and fair elections for the president. Next spring we will have elections, free and fair elections for the parliament. Then the Petersburg process is coming to an end. It's a tremendous success. I think the international community, Europe, United States, other partners, we have demonstrated that nation building is a real option. That in the fight against these new totalitarian and terrorist threat, we have a real option if we stay committed, if we stay committed to the Afghan people, if we stay committed to our basic principles, and if we are determined to engage ourselves for this success. I think this is a good example. And with this example in the background and with the experience of this example, we should really move forward in the strategic discussion I mentioned before. Let me raise one last element. In the 21st century, as I said before, the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Berlin Wall was not only the beginning of the collapse of the Soviet Union, of the communist bloc. It was also the end of the bipolar system, of the system of Yalta, and much more, as we realize now, it was also the end of the old-fashioned European system, of the Westphalian system. Today, if we look in a more theoretical, to the state system, it's an unparalleled situation. United States are struggling with the situation that they are the only superpower, the only world power. Others are struggling with this fact, thinking in terms of how can we balance that, create counterbalances. I don't believe in that. Globalization is a fact of the 21st century. What does globalization mean? And 9/11 is also a result of globalization. In the old days, I mean, what happened in the Hindu Kush area? What happened with the failed state, with collapsed state structures? I mean, it didn't matter in the same way as it matters today. This is also one of the consequences of a changes, not only in the economic system, but also in the international system. China today, what China is doing economically and financially is more important for the economic development of the United States as in the old days it ever could have happened. So we are now in a situation where we will have a highly integrated global economy with technologies where everybody will be part of this global reality. The internet, the media revolution. So everybody will be globalized. Then we see everything will be globalized. Then we see, on the other hand, our limited resources. So do we really believe, with the experiences of 9/11, of the threat of the new totalitarian threat, which is breeding in collapsed structures in states, do we really believe, with our limited resources, with our highly integrated economies, with our highly integrated technology, that in the midst of the 21st century, China will challenge the US in the traditional way, and we will see a clash of those two world powers? Do we really believe that? I can't believe that. I think the development will force us to cooperation. Of course, the states will continue to exist, rivalry will continue to exist. But what we need is an idea to create new institutions. How will we deal with the resources? Look to the oil markets today, look to the steel market, look to these tremendous change in the direction of the markets. Everything now is going towards China. And then the products will come back to the world market. Who will organize that? Is that only a result of a spontaneous development which will create a conflict of interests, which will create crises and confrontations? There will be no winner in the 21st century, only for a very short period. But if such conflicts and confrontations will happen, then you will see that the winner will be also the loser, because we are so integrated that I don't believe that there will be a future in this old balance of power system. If this is true, then we need a UN system which is the only way out. Then we need new ideas and institutions, maybe of global resources management and other institutions. If you look to the wisdom of the heads of states and government, They decided, I think, a brilliant initiative, the so-called, from my view, Millennium Global Goals. It's the absolute minimum for life of human beings in the 21st century. We must work on that to make that obligatory, not only a declaration, but a policy. How we can, the SARS crisis made it quite clear that in a globalized world with the transport not only of ideas and information, but also of human beings, we are highly integrated. New diseases can have tremendous negative effects on the economy, on the well-being of the people around the globe. So all these issues, education is another challenge. If it's true that the future will be a knowledge-driven economy, then the accession to knowledge, literacy, is crucial. And we must avoid a new dividing line between those who have access to these technologies, who are part of a knowledge-driven globalized economy, and those who are outside. So from my view, what we need is, on the one hand, we must understand there is the unique role of the United States, a very specific role, as the only global power which exists. But on the other side, the second pillar must be an effective UN system. I don't see an alternative to that. Coalitions of the willings cannot create what a UN system can create. And what is the real power of the UN system? They have no military, they are not a state. No, the UN creates legitimacy by consensus. And legitimacy, you can experience that in the present crisis, is really a hard currency. With legitimacy in your hand, things are much more easier to do than without, even for the most powerful. And therefore, from my view, the reform of the UN is crucial. And if we don't have the strength and the wisdom to do it, then I agree with Kofi Annan what he said in the opening speech this year for the General Assembly in New York City. Then history will teach us maybe one or two or several very bitter lessons until the community, the international community and their leaders will understand. For us, this reform of the UN system is crucial, and this means also, of course, not only a reform of the Security Council, but also a reform of the Security Council. If you want to create legitimacy, you need a broadly accepted representation of the political reality of today. These are it's a picture of how we see the world and where I think we need a strong European voice and a strong European actor. This is not directed against the role of the national states, as I said before, but even the biggest national states in the 21st century, the United Kingdom, the most powerful one, P5 members, permanent members in the Security Council, nuclear powers with a great tradition, United Kingdom and France, and the size of economy and population, the biggest member state, my country, we are not big enough to define our own interests without a strong Europe. And therefore, I think we must do our homework. Without balancing the interests of the nation states with the interests of the institutions of Europe, and this means the part of the European reality which is integrated, where we have pooled our sovereignty, without that, I believe we even will not secure our security and cannot in an efficient way contribute to our security. These are the challenges, and I hope I could give you some ideas in the way I think we should move forward. And because we are here in the London School of Economics, in the old days this was one of the best addresses. It was always a very living discussion, especially in 68. But now I'm on the other side of the barricade. I'm looking forward for a very controversial discussion with you. Thank you very much.
prefer to stay here or come to the hotel?
The Foreign Minister should understand that this place wasn't just controversial in the old days, and long may it be so. Thank you very much indeed. Now, Foreign Minister Fisher has very kindly agreed to answer some questions. We are, I'm afraid, very tightly pressed time-wise. The Foreign Minister is pressed, and we have to hand back the theatre to Sadler's Wells in a very short time. But we have got a few minutes, and I want a question, not a speech. Yes. Stand up, there's a microphone coming.
The correct answer is yes, sir.
No, in 1968 it would have been.
I was just wondering if you could tell us the likelihood in a reformed United Nations Security Council of either Germany or Europe receiving a permanent seat. Thank you.
Well, very easy. I would be in favor of a European seat. But if you go through the options, I mean, it would mean, what would it mean, a European seat? France and UK will never say, we are part of the Europeans now, there is our seat, integrated in the Europeans. I don't believe in that. As in the introduction was said, a realist. Now, but even if we would, and what would happen if we would have a European seat, a French seat, and a British seat? This would mean that the French have a seat, the British have a seat, and as Europeans, they have a second seat with the Europeans. I don't believe that this will be accepted and will raise serious, very serious questions also inside the European Union. Thirdly, the third option, European seat. Okay, put aside these serious questions we cannot solve and think it would be solved in one way or the other. And then who will be representing the European seat? There are, again, two options. The one option is in the type of the presidency we have today, that every half year, every 6 months, or maybe every year, there is a rotating representation. So it's quite clear with the bigger member states, Germany, Italy, Spain, Poland. But then we come in a region where it will be very complicated. So will you exclude the smaller member states, Luxembourg, Malta? Can Malta and Luxembourg represent a permanent seat in the UN? So these are very complicated discussions. I don't see that it could be really in a serious way done. So the only option, serious option, would be to say, okay, Solana, the future foreign minister, double-headed foreign minister, vice president, coming vice president of the Commission, and foreign minister of the European Union, if the constitution will be accepted, will represent it as a European seat. I would be in favor for that. But would Britain and France in favor for that? I don't believe it, because then serious questions will be immediately put on the table. Why have the European seats, and the members of the European Union, France and Britain, have their own seat? So I don't believe in that, as long as we have not a different stage of integration. So at the end, the question is, should Germany say, we are strongly backing the reform, we believe in multilateralism, we are the third biggest contributor in financial terms, the second biggest for UN-linked peace missions in troops. We are supporting that, but we are not a candidate. I don't believe that this makes sense. So these are the options. I understand that our Italian friends are not happy with that, but what shall I do?
Over there.
Hi, my name is Michael. I am a student of international relations at the NSE. Mr. Fisher, why is your government not willing to let the German people themselves vote directly on the European Constitutional Treaty? Don't you think that the Germans have a fundamental right themselves to decide on such a fundamental issue concerning Germany's and Europe's future? Thanks.
I mean, I was 11 days campaigning during the European election. I was for 7 weeks campaigning for federal elections. In the meanwhile, I was also days campaigning for state elections. And even by and then, very important local elections. I was working very hard for democratic support of my position. And we did well as Greens. So it was also support for my position and position of my party and our government that we want to ratify, we want a mandate, we said to the people, we want a mandate also to ratify this constitution. And they said yes. Now, it's a question of the tradition. And from my view, now I will say something very unpopular. As older I became, as more skeptical I am about referendums. I would be immediately for the referendum about the constitution. If we will talk about the constitution and decide. Yes means stay in and move forward with the constitution. No means get out and bear the consequences. I would be, if this would be the decision, definitely we'll make more than 70% or maybe more than 80%. Because there's a lot of frustration on the one hand in the electorate. On the other hand, I always hear from people, bipartisan, Europe must do this, Europe must do that. Why is Europe not acting here? Why is Europe not acting there? So there is a sense that it's Europe which must act. But this Europe is weak. This is not in a sufficient way prepared to act, with some exclusions. For example, in competition, it's quite clear. I mean, the British commissioner will represent 450 million consumers. That's very different from how many British people? More than 50 million British 60. People, 60. It's a very different backing. So from my view, if this would be the decision, I would be immediately in favor. But Pat Cox, a liberal, former president of the European Parliament and Irish, told me and my colleagues what it means to go in such a referendum. And he said, we discussed about everything, but only very few about the substance of the referendum. Now, I accept France has a different tradition, you have a different tradition, but please, a representative decision is not less democratic. Not less democratic. And by the way, we would make it in Germany. We would make it.
Don't go too far.
That's not the problem.
We may get some democracy. We've got, I'm afraid, only time for one more question. The person up there.
You've spoken about the need to reform the UN Security Council. What about the international legal order, specifically Article 2 sub 4 of the Charter and Article 51? Do these provide the tools with which to deal with the current challenges such as preemptive action and humanitarian intervention, or do we need to rethink the Charter and the rules as they currently stand?
It will be very complicated, but we have to rethink the policies, definitely, yes. And I think Article 51 makes quite clear the right of self-defense. And this was underlined in the decisions of the Security Council after 9/11. But with humanitarian intervention, I'm talking not only about the UN Security Council, I'm talking also the whole UN system. And regional organizations are an essential part of this UN system. Let me draw your attention to a development, I think, which is very, very important and very positive to Africa. When we had the Kosovo War in 1999, after the end of the Kosovo War, I had my first visit in Africa, and I met there a great, great reluctance to humanitarian intervention, because many of the African counterparts said quite directly that they fear this is another idea of the West, to intervene according to the interests, to very, it's not humanitarian interest, but very practical interests. And they were very, very suspicious that this is a new form of, let's say, in a direct way, of a neo-colonial interest. I said no at that time. Look to Africa, look to the situation. If there is a state where a dictator is really killing its own peoples, is driving a whole country into the collapse, this will hurt the neighbors, this will hurt the whole region. It's not only a humanitarian disaster, it's not only a moral scandal, but it's a direct security threat. Nowadays, if you go to Africa, if you go to the African Union, they have invented an own security council. And we have an ongoing tragedy and a very severe crisis in Darfur. But it's the first time that the Africans are really in a serious way engaged. The structures are weak, the institutions are weak, there's a lack of capabilities. We must deliver that to our African partners. But there is a complete difference in the mindset. The last meeting of the African Union in Addis Ababa, I spoke with a very high-ranking UN official who was on the way to Addis Ababa. Whether this will be on the agenda, yes or no, is that maybe informally? No. It was the top issue number one. And there you can see that, from my view, collective responsibility, collective security, is not an old-fashioned concept of the Cold War and of the period of coexistence. This is a very modern concept for a whole variety of regions in our world. And the modernized UN system means for me also these collective responsibility in security organizations. And by the way, that was exactly with the blocked Security Council what the Europeans, together with our American allies, did in the Balkans. We had exhausted all means. There was no alternative than to go in. The only criticism I have is that we all together, I mean, not only those who made the decisions, but also who opposed these possible decisions to intervene by military action. The only mistake from looking back from today, and I'm blaming myself for that, is that we didn't intervene early enough. After Vukovar, after the shelling of Dubrovnik, I think it would have been timely to say, if you want to divorce, do it like the Czechs and the Slovaks have done it in a peaceful way. We will be helpful. Or form a new constitution, and we will be helpful. We will be also helpful. That's exactly what Solana and Lord Robertson did with Serbia and Montenegro. That is exactly what Solana and Robertson and their staffs did in Macedonia in a very successful way. We didn't it in the beginning of the 90s, and from my view, and I'm not blaming the decision makers alone, everybody who was also opposing this, including myself, we made a mistake there, and many people have lost their lives, but I think this is an essential part. Now, how can you bring that in a new text of the charter or whatever? I think we must work on that. It's not easy because it could be also misused. I understand that perfectly well. But I think in the future of tomorrow, and therefore we highly appreciate the support also for the International Criminal Court, it must be quite clear. Sovereignty cannot mean that the dictator can do everything against its own people. Sovereignty cannot protect a situation where a whole country is mistreated in a terrible way, and at the end there is a collapse state and a security threat, and therefore I think we need mechanisms to deal with that, and the regional organizations and the regional consensus could be there an important element. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to close this meeting on behalf of the Centre for European Reform and the LSE But before I do so, with a very brief word, can I just make a practical point? When the minister leaves, can you all stay seated while he's leaving? That's for security reasons. The war in Iraq split Europe down the middle into Jack's gang and Tony's gang. It was rather like a school playground. And this was very damaging for Europe and very damaging for the transatlantic relationship. And I think we've heard today from Joschka Fischer that although he was actually part of Jack's gang, he has done a lot personally to try and bring the two sides together in Europe and across the Atlantic. On Iran, we've heard him urging the EU to be tough on the Iranian nuclear ambitions. On Israel, he insists in talking to Israel and tries to let the Israelis understand that he sees their security concerns. In the greater Middle East, he talks about democracy in the Arab countries, rather like the neocons do, actually. And when he talks about transatlantic relations, his tone is not critical of America, as is the tone of some of his colleagues in his government. And finally, on Turkey, as we heard most forcefully from him today, he sees the strategic benefits of Turkey getting closer to Europe in terms of ending a Huntingtonian clash of civilizations, even if some people in France think that Turkish membership is a kind of Anglo-Saxon plot to destroy the good old days of Franco-German domination of the EU. So for all these reasons, I say thank you very much, Minister, for doing your best to heal the wounds amongst Europeans and across the Atlantic, and long may you continue to do so. Thank you very much.
Very nice.